Dip, 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 dip. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Dip, 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 dip,
Good evening. This is the Labor Exchange, and I'm Dennis Kreese, a member of the Boulder Area Labor Council, AFL-CIO. Today is Labor Day, Monday, September 5th, 2016. And the subject of tonight's program is Labor Day, 2016, Unions in an Unstable Political Environment. With us is a special guest, as before, Dr. Ray Hoegler, Labor Law Professor and Professor of Management, Colorado State University, Fulbright Distinguished Chair in Law, University of Tuscia, Viterbo, Italy. Ray, thank you again for being on the Labor Exchange at KGNU.
I'm happy to be here, Dennis.
Ray, let's begin with a discussion of your recent op-ed in The Conversation, a publication of academic rigor and journalistic flair. And it was entitled, quote-unquote, How Labor's Decline Opened the Door to Billionaire Trump as Savior of American Workers. How has Trump, a wealthy estate mogul and reality TV star, managed to attract substantial support among white men without college degrees, a demographic that makes up the base of industrial unionism?
This was an interesting question for me, Dennis. And The Conversation is a media outlet which has a fair amount of readership, and this op-ed has gotten over 10,000 reads. So there is interest in this question, and I looked up some other information on the internet. I think there are plenty of people trying to answer this question, but my answer would be because of continuing inequality, there's a great deal of dissatisfaction out there among this demographic. And other people have commented on the fact that this really is the heart and soul of American unions. These white workers of a certain age without a college degree, I believe that they're troubled by the fact that they believe we're going backwards. And part of the backwards indication is the fact that wages have declined for some 30 years in this country. So they are appealing, Trump is appealing to them by virtue of the fact that he says he can fix it. And what he focuses on is trade. He believes that these trade agreements are the villain here. I don't think that's exactly correct, but it's an easy way for him to pin the blame somewhere where people will support him. And I thought it was kind of interesting this morning. Recently, Trump has been visiting Mexico, or did visit Mexico, and he doesn't talk anymore about the wall, but he comes back to the United States and he makes speeches again emphasizing that he's going to build a wall. I think that's what appeals to this segment of working Americans, because they blame this decline on international trade and not necessarily on any other factor.
All right then, Ray, let's move on with this. With the aforementioned demographic, white males without a college degree, what do they expect Trump will do for them? AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka has stated that he, Trump, is desperate to be working people's friends, but everything he does proves he is our enemy. Your comments on the former and the latter?
Sure. There was this interesting development during the Reagan era where a lot of union members voted for Reagan. I think they voted for him because he had a certain appeal, talking about how what we need to do is get the government out of the workplace. We need to lower taxes to take these steps that would free up the economy. Trump does the same thing. It's hard to see exactly, though, what Trump's policies are because he's contradictory and not very detailed about it. So on the one hand, he says, I will repeal these trade agreements. On the other hand, he says, it will be tax cuts, and tax cuts will make the economy boom again. This rhetoric has a certain appeal and has had a certain appeal for quite a while in this country. And I think Trumka has some difficulty because his union membership doesn't necessarily line up with what the leadership of the AFL-CIO think about this problem. So there's this sort of split and ambivalence in the labor movement about Trump, who says a lot of things that appeal to union members.
Ray, let's go on to this. Income inequality. Unions were a major force for economic equality in this country from 1947 to 1978. Since that time, unions declined and subsequently led to our present situation of massive income inequality. Could you present some reasons, economic and political, for the decline of unions?
I think what happened in the late 1970s was this period of extreme stagflation, economic uncertainty, and turbulence in the Carter administration. I date the decline of the contemporary labor movement from 1978 when they made their last best effort to try to reform the labor laws so that it would be easier to organize. And they fell two votes short in the Senate of the United States. There was a filibuster mounted against it. This legislation passed in the House overwhelmingly. Carter said he would sign it. It comes to the Senate, and they filibuster it. This is back in the day when you actually had to filibuster. They filibustered this thing through, I think, six votes, and they were unable to break that filibuster. And at that point, I think labor started to enter this long period of decline. The reason for that, as I said before, was in the 1970s, the economics began to shift a little bit, and with this inflation and with employers beginning to be much more aware of labor cost and other factors of doing business, the business environment was not very good. When Reagan came into office, a lot of people signaled the beginning of the end for labor with the air traffic controller strike. There are some issues around that because these guys engaged in an illegal strike, although they had done it before and never been punished. When Reagan fired them and replaced those air traffic controllers, that showed employers in the United States you could take a tough position against labor. The biggest decline since the 1920s in organized labor's membership was that decade of 1980 to 1990. I believe that was partly for the political climate. It showed employers you can be tough with unions. It was partly for the economic environment where unemployment exceeded 10% of the workforce. It was very hard economic times. And finally, when the economic conditions settled down, Reagan announced in 1984 we were entering a new morning in America, and people believed that. So there was this attraction to Reagan as a good, strong leader, and it was also the idea now we can have an environment which doesn't have labor unions. So employers cut labor costs, union membership declined. Together, those factors led to a very substantial deterioration of the labor movement. It's never really recovered. It's been downhill since then.
Ray, right-to-work states. How do these right-to-work states, especially the more recent ones, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, and West Virginia, factor into strong support for Trump from the white male working class? And beyond that, how do state right-to-work laws break down working class solidarity?
I think that's a key to it, Dennis. I've done a lot of research into right-to-work and published quite a bit about it. I think what right-to-work laws do is to break down this idea of community and cohesion and solidarity. They teach people, because the basis of right to work is that every individual ought to be free to get a job without constraints from unions. So this kind of mythos permeates the right to work rhetoric, and it talks about individualism. It talks about how people should have choices. All that's very appealing. But the right to work movement itself, I think it's clearly the greatest factor relating to the downfall of unions. I think right to work, and I've done research in this area with economists who are very good statistically, I think there's a very sound empirical basis to say right to work is the driver of union decline. When somebody like Mike Pence, who's Trump's running mate now, stands up and says in the Indiana state legislature, when he was governor of Indiana, he approved right to work, he upheld right to work, he likes right to work, he advocates right to work, he's very much in favor of right to work. And I think that factor alone disqualifies him as a friend of unions and the Trump administration. So this movement now, which is most recently manifested in West Virginia, this very strongly unionized coal industry, which is disappearing and leaving behind all these disgruntled workers who incidentally are going to go vote for Trump, these people, when they decide that they want a right to work law and they don't want unions anymore, it's a very significant shift in outlook, and I think it exemplifies exactly what Trump is able to tap into in his campaign.
You know, I shared that interview I had earlier in the year with Dan Pullen, a great friend of mine that's a business manager of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 53 in West Virginia, and a former state delegate. And, there were some other factors there. They had strong, you know, extremely big crowds to protest that in the state capitol at the beginning, 3,000, 4,000 union members and everything. But just their political system where, it only took a majority to override a governor's veto plus one state senator that they supported the labor movement and changed parties. And then when it came down to how he would have been the tie vote, in the state Senate, he just, conveniently took a job with the NRA as a lobbyist and, tilted the balance by one vote. And so there's lots of things going on there. Ray, let's get into something you're really good about explaining, and it's the role of culture. And as we've discussed in past interviews, could you discuss the role of culture in the context of hierarchical individualists versus collective egalitarianism, and the impact on election 2016 on a national, state, and local levels?
Sure. There's a group of scholars involved in this field that they call cultural cognition. What's interesting to me about it is they argue we don't make choices rationally. We make choices based on who we are as people. There's this little software program in our brain that filters through information we hear and tells us how to think about something. I do this with my classes all the time. There are certain hot-button issues out there in this country, like abortion, just to name one that's very powerful. How you feel about that really doesn't have much of a rational basis. You can offer reasons for or against it, but what counts is how you basically feel about it. And these people argue that the way you feel about it is because of these filters in your brain that give you information and tilt you in a certain direction. And they say there are two ways. And one is hierarchical individualism, which they say individuals are the supreme political unit of the United States. Individuals are the most important. Individual freedom is most important. But at the same time, they also recognize hierarchy in the sense that there are some historically in this country that white males had a certain degree of privilege and status, followed by by women and other ethnic groups. So there was this arrangement in which you look at the world as a certain way and you make sense out of it. This is very powerful. I think Trump plays right into that. He talks about how he went out and made $1 billion. He talks about how Obama is weak, and Obama is too, and Clinton, by implication, they're too socialistically oriented, makes comments like that, talks about how powerful he is. And the other side of this is the Bernie Sanders model. And the Bernie Sanders model says, We need to work together. We need to make sure that all groups are included. We need to have policies which help to redistribute wealth, because we don't believe wealth just accrues to people because of their individual merit. We don't believe markets are always fair. We think sometimes people work very hard, they don't achieve a decent living wage, so we should take action to deal with those problems, and these are the collective egalitarians. What these people, these researchers at Yale, found is that this is so ingrained in the way we look at the world that they've performed various experiments, and they show, for example, little clips of television to people, and they ask, is this an example of a policeman effectively performing his duties, or is he agitating the crowd? And they find that responses vary according to your orientation. So this line of research, I think, is very important in explaining the political divisions in this country. If you like to look at it in those terms, it's the difference between red states and blue states.
Okay. So, and it's probably going to follow the same pattern to pretty much the same extent as 212 and 208. But, Ray, let's kind of build on that. Union members, 2015. This report was issued by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, U.S. Department of Labor, this past January 28, 2016. It stated that 11.1% of the workforce were union members, 14.8 million overall, 7.2 million in the public sector, 35.2% of that sector, 7.6 million in the private sector, yet only 6.7% of that particular sector. Ray, you've reviewed this 11-page report. What is the message for the U.S. labor movement? And what areas of the United States will unions be a positive factor for election 2016?
It's really hard to say. Unions usually get a good turnout. They have a lot of political influence. They have a lot of political mobilization. But the interesting thing about these numbers is that it shows private sector unions, where private sector unions should be stronger to be able to bargain for higher wages and benefits, are declining. In the public sector, unions are more powerful, they have better membership density than ever in the private sector. That's perplexing, because public sector union members don't have as much right to bargain over wages and other workplace benefits. Those are usually presented by the government as this is the deal. You can take it or leave it. They do negotiate for grievance procedures, things like that. In the private sector, where unions can negotiate over almost anything having to do with employment, this is where they're breaking down. And the numbers that you cite there are also clear, that union members make higher wages than do non-union members. And they have a term for it, the union wage premium. And the union wage premium is still apparent. The problem is that fewer and fewer people actually get that union wage premium. I was looking, there's some discussion about Trump's hotels out in Las Vegas, you may know. He has some labor union issues there, but the Culinary Workers Union, they quoted somebody saying, the unionized workers here in Las Vegas make $3 an hour more than the non-union workers. And Trump's workers are unionizing, and Trump doesn't necessarily like that. So this thing about higher wages, employers in the private sector say, well, if I could just cut those wages, or I can dampen down the demand for higher wages, I can put that money in my pocket. In other words, I can give it back to shareholders, I can use it as profits. You've read about these CEOs, the woman who whose company holds the rights to the EpiPen.
Oh, God, yeah.
$15 million. Yeah, so that's where it goes. And part of the reason that I think employers in the private sector are able to squeeze workers like that is because union density is down, and they continue to try to drive it down.
Ray, let's get into, we have about 8 minutes left. I have three key questions I want to ask you. In state legislatures, as per our past interviews, why are these elections for state representatives and state senators just as important, possibly more critical, for all unions and their members, and subsequently all workers and their families throughout the United States? And I just want to note, here in Colorado presently, the state Senate is 18 Republicans, 17 Democrats. The state House is 34 Democrats, 31 Republicans. Go ahead.
Sure. One of the things that Democrats tried to do in 2006 when they gained a majority in both houses was to repeal the Labor Peace Act. That's this modified right-to-work bill in the United States. I think that that illustrates exactly why this is important, because these state legislatures are often dominated, if you will, by ALEC and the American Legislative Exchange Council. There are plenty of legislatures in the states, legislators who are schooled by ALEC, and that's, I think, a dangerous proposition. The second thing is there's so many issues that can be regulated at the state level that affect union members and working people that it's important not to, in my mind, not to allow control over important areas to be given to Republican legislatures, because what they do, as illustrated by the case of Missouri, there's a very rich guy back there who's already given about $2 million in this campaign to make sure that Missouri remains Republican in its state legislature, because he wants right-to-work laws passed. The same is true with minimum wage. States have the authority to raise the minimum wage if they want to do that. They have the authority to impose other kinds of restrictions, safety and health restrictions. This is all important. That's why these battleground states are key. Just to give one further example, when political conservatives get a hold of a state legislature, they do things like North Carolina, and they pass transgender bathroom laws. I don't think that thing has any substantive impact in terms of what it was designed to do, that is to protect people who use the privacy of people in public restrooms. But what it does do is to send a very powerful signal to the rest of the United States. Now, that's what state legislatures can do. And I think it's important in Colorado, for example, every time we have one of these issues come up, like this repeal of the Labor Peace Act, that was a battle that cost millions of dollars for political parties in the state of Colorado, unions to try to defeat it, business to try to defeat it, and unions to try to make it happen. So that's key to understanding, I think, the political process relative to labor. One further point, public sector unions are not covered under the Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, and therefore state legislatures have control over them, and you see over and over again state legislatures now attacking public sector unions, and that's the most vulnerable area of union activity in the country, I think. So there are all these issues that can be resolved at the state level, and either favorably or not to labor.
Ray, Hillary Clinton, Tuesday, August 30th, a couple days ago, I sent you the email I received from President Richard Trumka, AFL-CIO. In a nutshell, the endorsement of Hillary Clinton is far and away a clear choice compared to Donald Trump. Do you have any comments on Richard Trumka's message and its contents?
Yeah, the trouble with Richard Trumka's message, as I said before, is there may be this disconnect between labor leadership and union members. And so Trumka endorses Hillary Clinton. I think that's a great thing. He also criticizes Trump and attacks him for his positions. That's great in terms of trying to motivate labor union members in one direction. The problem is it doesn't always work, because as in 1980, when official labor supported a Democratic candidate and Reagan won handily, that didn't work out very well. So when labor comes out in favor of a political candidate, That's sometimes a risky proposition, and I think this election is particularly that way because rank-and-file workers may not have the same outlook that Trumka does, even though he may be correct on the ground.
It's funny.
Hillary would be better for workers.
It's funny you mention that because I remember an old business agent with the Labor's Local 720, and you know, it was before I was for about 2 years an agent with him as well. He and I talked late part of the '80s. You know, it was after Reagan, or maybe while Reagan was still in his second term, and he talked about a labor endorsement for certain candidates is you know metaphorically the kiss of death, and
yeah.
And it was like, and I think in some places in the country it still may be that. Ray, we have a couple minutes left, and I definitely want to talk about this. I think it's ultimately, you know, perhaps the most important thing, and that's voter turnout. How will the level of voter turnout impact all federal, state, and local elections this coming Election Day, Tuesday, November 8, 2016? And how will draconian and discriminatory photo ID laws and other factors play a part in this whole process in many states throughout the United States?
Well, there's this whole panoply of Republican strategies, which included gerrymandering, voter registration laws, this whole dimension of trying to keep people from voting or effectively being able to vote. So I think turnout is going to be absolutely crucial. The reason for that is pretty simple. I mean, it's easy to identify groups who are against Trump, Hispanics, you know, minority groups, women, for example. They may hate Trump, but if they stay home, what does that matter? And on the other hand, I think Trump voters are highly motivated. You know, these are not people who just talk about how they like Trump. They're going to turn out to vote for him. So I think voter turnout is crucial. And whether that happens or not, it remains to be seen.
All right, then, Ray, we have about 45 seconds. And as always, for a summary, do you have any final thoughts or comments in the context of this evening's subject, Labor Day 2016, unions in an unstable political environment?
Sure. I think if inequality is a problem in this country, unions are the answer to at least most scholars say 30% of inequality over the past four decades are attributable to the decline of unions. So if we really care about inequality, we could at least give unions some kind of a break instead of allowing employers and legislatures just to bash them all the time. I don't have any hopes for a national labor law that would be far-reaching and make radical change, but there could be some things to be done that would make it a little easier for unions to organize and for workers to have a better voice in the workplace.
All right, then, Ray. For those of you who have joined us late, the subject of tonight on Labor Day, 2016 was Labor Day 2016, unions in an unstable political environment. And with us was Dr. Ray Hoegler, labor law professor and professor of management, Colorado State University, Fulbright Distinguished Chair in Law at the University of Tuscany of Viterbo, Italy. Ray, thank you for being on Labor Exchange at KGNU. And for those of you who have any comments about this show or any other show on KGNU, please call 303-447-9911. And next week, Monday, September 12, 2016, please listen to La Lucha Sigue at 6 p.m. This has been the Labor Exchange, and I am Dennis Kreese for KGNU Boulder, KGNU Denver, and KGNU.org.